Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and joining me on the program today is Smith Henderson. His new novel is Fourth of July Creek. He joins us by telephone from somewhere out on the West Coast. Where are you at? Portland?
Portland, yep. Portland, Oregon. Thanks for having me.
Smith, welcome to the program. I'm really grateful that you got some blurbs from a couple of writers that I truly admire. I picked up a copy of your book a few months ago, and I looked and I saw that you'd gotten a blurb from Philip Meyer and from Claire Vey Watkins, and I said to myself, I've got to read this book because I love their stuff so much, and I know that they're not people that give a lot of blurbs.
No, they sure don't, and they're both fantastic writers, so that was a really... For me, that was a quick recognition of, oh, wow, okay, maybe this book's all right.
And I'm guessing you probably ran into Philip at the University of Texas, and you probably ran into Claire at Bucknell.
Yeah, exactly. That's how I actually had the pleasure of getting to know them a little bit before I got to know them. Well, about the same time, I guess, I was reading their stuff. So, yeah, it was great. They're both really, really kind people.
I'll say. They've both been on this program, and that's how I knew blurbs do help me, and I read your book, and I loved it, and this is your first book.
Yeah, I was working on it for about a decade. It was originally, it was kind of two books in my mind, and I finally realized that this story of this boy that was living in the woods with his father took me a couple years to realize that narrative meshed really well with the other story I was writing about a child protective services worker. Once I saw that those two storylines overlapped and were actually somewhat explosive, I decided to start over and dive in.
So you had one story about Pete Snow, the social worker, and you had another story about Jeremiah Pearl.
Yeah, Benjamin and Jeremiah Pearl.
Okay.
I just had this vision of them, you know, these people living in the woods, and was writing kind of around that. And then I thought, well, it would be interesting to see if the social worker has some way to be concerned about them, and it developed out of that.
And most of it's set in Montana, which I understand is very familiar territory for you. In fact, I read the New York Times Magazine last week, and I saw that you'd written the end piece, and it was an autobiographical sketch that you'd written. And after reading it, I thought, this guy's had a very interesting background.
Yeah. Montana's a pretty fascinating place. It's got a reputation, you know, being a place that's beautiful, but there's also there's a real fiercely independent streak in the people that live there. And it took me a long time to realize that, you know, that actually moving away to see that that place was actually fairly interesting in and of itself, and that it would be a good setting. It took me a while to realize that. I think a lot of writers feel that way at first, like wherever they're from isn't inherently great, and then at some point you discover that other people are actually interested in it.
We had James Lee Burke on the program the other day, who now lives in Montana, and I was sorely tempted to ask him during the interview, have you read Fourth of July Creek by Smith Henderson? But I didn't want to put him in that position. But I thought, you know, I really would love to turn him onto this book if he hasn't read it.
Let's call him.
you both have this atmospheric thing going on.
I really like that comparison. There's an element to my book that I think is strongly in the genre of almost a detective novel.
Uh-huh.
It's, you know, but instead of a cop or a private eye or whatever, it's, you know, it's a child protective services investigator. But those kinds of stories about people trying to find out, you know, what's happened or what's going on, what the mystery is, lend themselves to certain atmospherics. You just kind of naturally come by, I think, when you're working on a story like that.
And it's a multiple mystery. There's layers of mystery. We've got your protagonist, who is kind of a damaged guy, and he really relates to other people that are damaged, being a social worker. This guy's got a big heart, but his own personal life is just a mess.
Yeah. And I think, we're picking up in the book right in the middle of everything really being a big mess. But honestly, as the story unfolds and you see kind of his childhood and his family and where he comes from, you can see, I think, simultaneously how he's so good at connecting with people in the area where he works in northwestern Montana, because he knows them. He knows the things they struggle with, and at the same time you understand why he is also somewhat trapped in his the flaws that he's been born with.
Smith Henderson joins us. His book is 4th of July Creek. The title refers to the spot where he finds this survivalist and his son, where he's, I don't want to do any spoilers here, but he's one of these guys, as a social worker, he's looking for people who need help. So he's trying to give these fiercely independent people food and clothing and stuff that they need. And he has a really hard time delivering the goods, doesn't he?
Yeah, I mean, his first interaction with Pearl, ends with Jeremiah Pearl making his son Benjamin take off all the clothes that Pete had bought for him and scampering off into the woods and in the cold, and Pete says, I wouldn't have given you I wouldn't have brought him back if I thought you were going to do this. And, the man said, I'd kill my son before I'd let you have him. And so you quickly see that this is not just a, run-of-the-mill kind of damaged family that, is like slightly resisting. It's a pretty actively, fiercely independent and resistant person that he's dealing with. And the book, concerns itself with trying to break down that barrier.
I love the way you introduce the 11-year-old son into the story.
Oh, thank you.
It's like this, it's like something out of the Bible.
Uh-huh. Thank you very much. Oh, thanks. That's really flattering. I think that he's that boy is I needed to feel as a writer, I guess, first, and then hopefully you feel as a reader that there's the preciousness of that kid. I don't think he's like a complete innocent, but he is a child. And so it was important to me that, and I think throughout the book, actually, my hope is that the takeaway from it is that they see people continue to make mistakes, but they still have compassion for them and they still root for them. I tried to write a very empathetic book.
I think one of my favorite parts in the whole story is when your social worker is with the father and son out in the middle of nowhere in some incredibly beautiful place, and they've created this shelter in this amazingly remote, beautiful area. And it's just, it's really transcendent to read about this, just the whole feeling of Pete being up there in this really amazing living area with these very strange people.
Yeah, you can kind of understand how people are drawn to the West in general and to Montana in certain places, in Montana in particular, because they are so beautiful, but they're also very hard to live in. So you get the reward of having, some of the most beautiful landscapes you can imagine. But some real long, hard winters, the wilderness is still a wilderness. So, if you're eking out a living up there, all my people are cowboys and my dad's still a logger and my great grandfather like dynamited the mountains to make the railroad and stuff like that. And those people that live out there are, proud of what they're able to do to survive and make it out there.
So how did you ever get away?
well, I mean, I still, you know, I don't know if I am ever all the way away. I still spend a good deal of time in Montana, and you know, it's where all my people are. But I was always drawn to the written word, and you know, lost myself a lot in books and stories. So I, from a very early age, I knew I was going to write. I was talking to a friend the other day. I think I've done about just about every writing job there is, from journalist to writing correspondence for a university chancellor or two, whatever. You know, whatever it pays, I'll do it, you know? It's just something, as long as it keeps me writing, I feel like I'm doing the right thing.
Smith Henderson joins us, and his book is 4th of July Creek. And I heard a rumor that even though most of our listeners probably haven't read your book, they've probably seen your work.
Oh, are you talking about the Super Bowl commercial I worked on?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. That was a pretty singular experience doing copywriting in the last couple of years. And I had this fantastic opportunity to be part of a spot that, you know, got to play in front of 100 and something million people. So that was, it's pretty unique when you get an opportunity like that.
So advertising is your day job.
Yeah. I work at a really great place called Wieden & Kennedy in Portland, Oregon. And it's an independent shop that, you know, really sort of specializes in, making things that are good. I work with a lot of really smart people every day. Are very, very challenging kind of environment. So I do that, but I find that it complements my other writing in a strange way. I get up first thing, and I still do my same deal. I get up in the morning, have, you know, a pot of coffee, write my stuff, and then go in and I get to do it for the rest of the day, you know, but in a different way. Still using those muscles, but in different kind of calisthenics. So it's good.
Smith Henderson joins us. His debut novel is 4th of July Creek, and it was a long time coming. He worked on it for 10 years, and he joins us on the program today. Give our listeners an overview without doing any spoilers. I know you won't do any spoilers. Give us sort of the gist of where we're going here. We've got these twin mysteries. I haven't referred to the one besides the Pearl mystery. The Pearl mystery is a big one, but there's another family mystery, and I don't know how much you want to delve into that.
No, you can go ahead and talk about it. I mean, there's a couple of, I mean, he's a, you know, Pete's a Child Protective Services investigator. So, you know, he has cases all over the region that he serves, and he works in this very remote region of northwestern Montana. And so there's another family that kind of forms a thread that kind of illustrating some of the difficulties of his job. He's trying to keep this boy Cecil from going into a juvie facility where he's probably going to turn out, you know, worse than he is.
Uh-huh.
And then there's the issue of Pete's own personal life. His wife and daughter have pretty much given up on him. You know, when I was doing research into this book, I obviously consulted a lot of the literature on social work and spoke with people in the field and researchers. And one of the things I came across was this notion of secondary trauma. Which is something that affects all first responders, you know. So anybody who's just regularly exposed to, you know, just really tough stuff, but especially Child Protective Services workers who, you know, are seeing things that have happened to children, come away with, like, quite a bit of their own what's called secondary trauma, which is just from that exposure.
Huh.
And nowadays the field is, you know, really advanced, and there are quite a few opportunities and resources for people in that field to get the help that they need. But I just thought, you know, I want wanted to situate my book in a time and place where there's a guy who couldn't get those resources and see him try and struggle. And it's, you know, it's inherently more dramatic, obviously, but also I just wanted to highlight the challenges that these people face in keeping their own sanity.
So we are able to see that secondary trauma turned into secondary drama.
Yeah, exactly.
I love your device where you have these pages that are interstitial, I guess you'd say, between the main narrative, and they're not numbered. And as a reader, we're trying to figure out, is this a conversation between Pete and his daughter? Is this a conversation between Pete's mind and his daughter's mind? Is this just something out in the ether? What is this? And it's intriguing. And as we read it, we keep wondering all through the book what this is.
Yeah. I've been asked about that a little, you know, fair amount. And, you know, I can tell you, for me, I wrote these sections in sort of a almost like a deposition, or, you know, just a question and answer, basically. Huh. And it's funny because I actually, you know, that's just a way I use to often to just generate material and then go back and turn it into a narrative. But for some reason, these sections having to do with Pete's daughter seem to work for me on some really on some poetic or you know, some other level. Where I didn't feel the need to, I wanted them to be in these spaces where they were kind of out of time, and you weren't quite sure who's asking a question, who's getting an answer. And the effect on me as a reader, you know, going back over it and reading it and thinking like, how, why is it like this? Why do I like it like this? Was just the recognition that it created a lot of anxiety in me. And that storyline for her was difficult, and I felt like having it be written in that way made it even feel even more fraught.
I agree.
Thank you.
So it's almost like, now that you've described what you were doing and how that came about, it's almost like the reader is allowed to peer over your shoulder at your work product as you're writing. It's like you've decided, this section, I was going to do something else with it, but I decided it's much more powerful the way it is.
Sometimes I think, you know, every once in a while you get lucky and something just kind of falls out of your head, like a, you know, in a form that you find pleasing, and you say, okay, well, this is going to stay like this. But that's not the case for 99% of the stuff I write, but every once in a while that happens. And this, I'm not saying that all these sections came out perfect, you know, perfectly. I went back and revised them, but the device stuck.
Well, we do get the sense, this is a big book, that you've done a lot of polishing over the years, that you've gone back and that you're one of these meticulous writers that polishes every single word.
Thank you. I mean, it's I wanted to write a book that I would like to read. Uh-huh. And doing that, the kinds of stuff I like to read do to me feel very. I like things that are beautiful. So I hope that I made something that's approaches that.
Well, there's a lot of tension here. You've got the tension with the pearls and what eventually happens to them. I love the device of these coins that keep turning up. I just was fascinated by this.
Jeremiah Pearl, but really, you spend enough time with that character, you're going to have to come to a place where you understand why they are where they are. And I was always interested in that. I never sat down and just judged this guy, you know. I wanted to see what was motivating him. And so ultimately it became money, was his kind of intellectual philosophical hobby horse, you know. And the thing was, I mean, I'm somewhat in agreement with some of his issues. I mean, I defy anyone to explain to me in really simple terms, you know, like our world economic system. I mean, it's pretty, you know, it's pretty convoluted stuff. And, and he's thinking, you know, he's along those lines. Like, what's the deal here? This is, we're all working for money, but why, you know, what is it really? And that's part of what is, you know, part of what's making him a little bit batty, but, to some extent, I admire that, you know, not going batty, but just that you would take these things seriously. I mean, just a, for instance, I've completely given up that any sort of an email or a text I send is private. Uh-huh. I don't know when I gave up, but I did, and most of us have. And I guess, like, maybe Edward Snowden's the only one really doing anything about it, and Glenn Greenwald or whoever, you know. And so, you know, I mean, I just thought it would be, there's a part of me that identifies with Pearl and his concerns. And so I, you know, created that character.
Well, it's one thing to volunteer for surveillance, like doing a radio show and hoping that thousands of people will be listening that you don't know. And they're going to go out and go, Smith Henderson, 4th of July Creek, that sounds like a really interesting book. Or you've got the opposite, where you've got thousands of people at the NSA who are reading Smith Henderson's emails right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Have fun, guys.
Well, this thing with the coins was really sweet. And I could picture these coin collectors out there wildly looking for these special coins.
I thought that was one of those things, you know, you think, okay, you have a character who's doing X, Y, or Z, and then you think through the repercussions of that act, right? And I just thought it would be, it just seemed interesting and plausible to me that if he was marking up coins and leaving them in places as these sort of protests, people would start to collect them.
And notice it, like, gosh, someone's defacing U.S. currency. Now, what kind of attention is this going to attract?
Yeah, exactly. Which seems like kind of a small thing until you start seeing them all over the place. And you wonder what's going on behind this. So it seemed a little spooky, too.
So we've got the tension with the pearls, and then we've got this family tension where Pete is worried about his daughter. And there's all this peripheral stuff. You've got these side stories, like Pete is supposedly on the right side of the law. He works for the government. He's a social worker. But he's got a brother who isn't quite on the right side of the law.
Yeah. His brother's been to jail quite a few times. Pete's family comes from a fairly successful, you know, ranching family, and he and his brother didn't have a fantastic relationship with their father, and they grew up a little bit spoiled because people were, you know, so impressed and intimidated by their father that they kind of got away with a lot more than they should have growing up. And for Pete's younger brother, that's just resulted in a lot of incarcerations. And so early on in the novel, he's really beaten up his parole officer who confronted him in a store buying beer, I believe. Uh-huh. and then he winds up going on the lam. So I mean, like I said earlier, it was this idea of trying to convey that this is that Pete's a guy who understands the kinds of people he's trying to help. You know, because people who do have trouble with the law or substance abuse, as he very much does. He's an alcoholic.
Well, it's this dense tapestry where we have all these main storylines, but you never know when that wild Adam is going to come bouncing back into the picture of the enraged parole officer. It's like, well, we forgot about him.
He's very angry, and it's pretty sure that Pete is hiding his, you know, his brother. Yeah.
And I like Pete's drinking buddies. He's got this gang that he hangs out with.
Oh, yeah, thank you. I like those guys, too. They seem like a good time. He's got this, you know, this group, and they don't figure into the plot in any large way. But they're his friends.
Well, you need to take a break. You need to go chill out.
Yeah.
And they have his back.
Yeah. It's kind of that idea that he's a guy who knows his clients really well, knows their world. And some of them are, you know, people who are his friends. They're not literally his clients, but they're the kind of people who live real close to, some kind of an edge, whether it's law or, you know, substance abuse or just, you know, general dereliction.
And with all these damaged souls wandering the terrain, then we have this almost saint-like character who Pete will turn to when he's got a really hard case and he's trying to get some abused, damaged kid a nice place to live where the kid will feel safe. He's got this guy that he goes to who's just like, he's like a saint.
Yeah, I mean, he's, there's some people, you know, that I know, you know, that are, you know, like good country people, I guess, you know, that live in smaller communities in Montana and in the West in general. And, you know, they're often pretty religious or regular churchgoers and, you know, are just the most generous types, you know, will totally be there for their family, of course, but then sometimes, then often for their community, and they're more than willing to open their homes and, you know, let a troubled kid stay there for a little while and, you know, see how it goes.
Well, Smith, I really enjoyed this book, and it's really been a pleasure having you on the program.
Oh, thank you so much. It was great talking to you today.
The book is 4th of July Creek. My guest has been Smith Henderson, and you heard about it on the Book Nook. Thanks, Smith.
Thank you.
For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McKeonis. ...2014 has turned into quite a year for debut novels. That one by Smith Henderson, 4th of July Creek, absolutely knocked me out. And we've had a couple other authors on the program this year with really great debut novels. Renee Denfeld with The Enchanted and Catherine Faw Morris with Young God. All great books. Coming up next week, Ivy Pakoda with her second novel. It's called Visitation Street. Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.